This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 14th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 173. Happy Family Day, Happy Valentine's Day, and Happy Lunar New Year of the Ox. Xingnan Kuai Le, Gong Xi Fa Chai, Gong Hei Fa Choi. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. BC casinos remain closed due to the pandemic, but the Cullen Commission public inquiry into money laundering in BC is going full tilt. Hear former River Rock Casino executive Walter Sue explain how the Richmond Casino used Lunar New Year to attract whale gamblers and how it profited from geopolitics in China, Hong Kong, and Macau. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or do British Columbians need to stop being so smug? On February 12th, Washington State reached the 1 millionth coronavirus vaccine shot milestone. British Columbia remained on a snail's pace to reach 200,000. There are more people vaccinated in the Seattle area than in all of BC. King County has half BC's population. There are twice as many vaccinated in Oregon than in all of BC. Oregon's population is 4.8 million compared to BC's 5.2 million. Blame goes to the Trudeau Liberal government in Ottawa, but the Horgan NDP government in Victoria is being too patient and won't say a bad word about Trudeau. Meanwhile, Trudeau Liberal MPs have criticized BC for not adopting the federal contact tracing app and for not using the rapid test kits sent in bulk from the Public Health Agency of Canada. Last spring, the World Health Organization said the key to defeating this pandemic is to test, trace, isolate, and treat. BC is not promoting the PCR test like it should. It is also not using the rapid test like it should. So the numbers in BC look artificially low, but the virus still spreads, especially with mutations from UK, South Africa, and now Nigeria. BC cannot afford a third wave of this virus. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Apple Daily, Year of the Bull off to a bearish start for factories and their workers without state aid. Migrant workers have been encouraged to spend the new year where they work. Some factories also cut short the holiday season, scheduling a return to work on the 6th or 7th day of the Lunar New Year instead of the usual 15th day. Civil servants and employees at state-owned enterprises must get permission to go home, with some provinces demanding negative COVID-19 tests before people can return. Train journeys taken in the first 4 days of the spring festival rush fell by 70%, the state council said. Meanwhile, state broadcaster CCTV's annual four-hour New Year's TV variety show raised eyebrows when performers wore African costumes, including blackface. Reuters noted comments on China's Weibo social media platform, including this one, quote, "Is there any difference between Chinese people doing blackface and white people slanting their eyes to make fun of Asians?" End quote. China's foreign ministry claimed inclusion of African culture was a show of respect. In the Japan Times, China's zero-corona policy frustrates Japanese nationals in Beijing. On January 27th, one day before the start of the 40-day spring festival travel season, known as the world's biggest human migration period, the Beijing government abruptly announced stricter steps to restrict movement of people to prevent the intrusion of the novel coronavirus. Authorities have prohibited entry to the capital by anyone outside the city without a certificate showing a negative result from a PCR test for the virus that causes the disease, taken within 7 days of their arrival. Measures will remain until March 15th, when the 10-day annual session of the National People's Congress, China's rubber-stamp parliament, is expected to end. In ABC News Australia, Victoria coronavirus outbreak likely to grow, as Melbourne Airport Terminal 4 listed as exposure site. Authorities said the outbreak started with a family of three who stayed in the Holiday Inn after returning from overseas, where they are believed to have become infected. There are now 13 cases linked to the Holiday Inn Melbourne Airport Hotel outbreak, and authorities have identified 905 primary close contacts, Authorities suspect that all the Holiday Inn outbreak cases are infected with the UK variant of the virus. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Mount Shasta Herald, Oregon wolf relocates to Northern California, finds mystery partner. California is home to two new gray wolves, at least one of which relocated from Oregon. OR85 is from Oregon's Mount Emily pack in the northeastern corner of the state near Pendleton. He was collared in February 2020 and struck out on his own in June. The wolf, with shaggy black fur, took a short trip to Nevada and then returned to Oregon before crossing the border into California's Modoc County in early November. In the Seattle Times, police officer partnered in businesses with Auburn area Proud Boy, charge in capital siege, records show. Renton cop Trevor Davidson privately partnered in two business ventures with Ethan Nordin, the self-prescribed sergeant-at-arms of the Seattle chapter of the right-wing extremist group, the Proud Boys. Nordin now stands accused of leading an angry mob of Trump supporters at last month's deadly rampage through the U.S. Capitol. After the Seattle Times shared public records showing Davidson's business ties to Nordin with Everett and Renton police, spokespersons for each force said their departments didn't immediately know about the relationship, but would review it. Check news. Safety Board says BC Ferry traveling too fast, failed to respond to commands in 2020 terminal crash. When the master of the Spirit of Vancouver Island ordered the helmsman to steer hard to avoid the crash last April, the ferry didn't respond. In the final moments before the crash at the Swanson Terminal, the master ordered both anchors released as an additional safety measure. However, the report outlines that neither one released properly. Two crew and one passenger sustained minor injuries. And these headlines in the Breaker.News. Ex-Temple boss and Scheer operative who split with Trudeau, dead after fall in Richmond. BC Health Authority boss fired after review of botched bulk mask buy. And exclusive video. Abbotsford mayor went out of his way for fake photo op. Read the stories behind these headlines at thebreaker.news.
This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
Last week, the Cullen Commission Public Inquiry on Money Laundering in British Columbia heard from several current and former Great Canadian Gaming and BC Lottery Corporation bigwigs. One of them was Walter Sue, who was Great Canadian's Vice President of Player and Gaming Development until 2019. Sue started with the company back in 1983 when it operated Vegas-style table games at the Pacific National Exhibition Fair. Sue's job at River Rock, to welcome high rollers from Asia, came under the microscope after the NDP government came to power in 2017. Walter Sue testified February 9th at the Cullen Commission about the casino in the most ethnic Chinese city outside of China. Commission lawyer Kyle McCleary asked Sue about the strategies that resulted in the Richmond Casino near the Fraser River becoming a magnet for both whale gamblers and loan sharks. Sue testified that Chinese New Year was key every year to River Rock's success, and then there was that year that it happened the same weekend as the 2010 Winter Olympics opened.
The period leading up to the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics, and you describe in your affidavit that there were some fairly significant enhancements to the VIP or high limit offerings at the River Rock around that time. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And those included the development of a new, more private high limit space on the third floor of the casino?
Yes, we rushed to get that prepared and launched in time for the Olympics, for Chinese New Year, which that year was, I'll never forget, Valentine's Day, February 14th. It was a late Chinese New Year that year. The Olympics had opened up 2 days earlier, the two-week event, February 12th. And so I was really fearful of that overlap. I remarked in my affidavit, I clearly remember that there was a problem in Las Vegas. People told me, our customers that went down for Chinese New Year that year told me. It was just one of those unfortunate situations that the mayor of Las Vegas at that time, Oscar Goodman, was really trying to wine and dine David Stern, the NBA commissioner at that time, to allowing Las Vegas to have a NBA team. He didn't do that, but he managed to convince him to conduct the All-Star game there. The game day on that Sunday weekend was Chinese New Year Day. Chinese from all over, not just North America, but even Asia, because Chinese New Year is for main businesses shut down for essentially 9 to 12 days, would do their annual pilgrimage there. And our players did as well, too. Our players, I clearly recall that if they were going down for 3 or 4 days, I saw them back in one day. They were traumatized that essentially the crowd that the NBA game attracted, in their words, was a war broke out between East Coast and West Coast rappers. They were in elevators accosting these Asians that were very wealthy that were playing on property, and they vowed never to go to Las Vegas Chinese New Year again. It was a publicity, a PR disaster for Las Vegas. They vowed never to hold the NBA All-Star game there again. It might be a bit dramatic compared to what I was thinking, but at the same time, our hotel was overbooked, and not by Asian people coming back for Chinese New Year. I recall that year, because the Olympic Oval was a speed skating oval, that there was a large contingent of Dutch, a large contingent of Germans that were coming in and partying after the events every day that the events were held. There was a lot of interest for Russians to have Russia House, Heineken House for the Dutch, etc. And it basically was going to be a party zone. And so I had early worries and concern about that. The third floor was a concept that would protect them off the main floor, where these party people were primarily going to enjoy themselves during the night. So that was the start of that concept. But a lot of people may not remember in the company that we started going to the third floor in just a small little section the year before, the Chinese New Year before. It was our first kind of dip into the water, where we had two private rooms, semi-private rooms, and a little configuration of four tables. It did all right, but it didn't do the way that we hoped it would.
Walter Sue also said River Rock relied on word of mouth on both sides of the Pacific Ocean.
Specific to Chinese New Year is because we knew there was a huge cluster of people coming back to repatriate with their families. And so that gave us the storefront for when they left and went back and told their friends, who all had status in Vancouver as well, too, that would come back throughout the year. They would be our walking advertising boards of saying, hey, I was just in River Rock during Chinese New Year. They've created this product. It's really good. We like it. The next time you go there. And so from a marketing perspective for year round, and also for the height of Chinese New Year, it worked out for us. And it worked out for us every year. I would say from 2010 to 2014.
In July 2015, $13.5 million in $20 bills was bet at River Rock. But Walter Sue said the BC government's stubborn insistence on cash for so many years was a barrier to River Rock's ambitions.
By 2010, the world had morphed into cashless, much more cashless, as the smartphone was being developed. You can see that other solutions, payment solutions, that was non-cash. And yet for us, it was still only cash. So there was a concern that I felt, not reputational, but image-wise, that it didn't fare well for us. There was no other casinos that I can think of in the world, but especially in North America, that would only accept cash. And so it was becoming a very big concern for us that as the business got a lot larger, again, not only the cash coming in, from my perspective, as people see the cash coming in, I guess because of my development background, I was seeing what cash was not bringing in. As a matter of fact, cash was a barrier to revenue coming in, and specifically people from all over the world that wanted to play with us, and as well to what I had found out and proven to myself and through the branch office and the Las Vegas executives that were marketing in our area, there was this money there that just was not available, not willing to walk into us because of the cash rule. So I found that cash was actually a big deterrent in our ability to advance the business forward.
According to former Great Canadian Gaming Vice President Walter Hsu, River Rock's success was about being at the right place at the right time. Hsu called it a twist of fortune. Even Xi Jinping's rise to power in China led to bigger profits at River Rock.
Is that meant to indicate that the River Rock was trying to attract players who would not be able to play in Macau because they were linked to corruption?
No. What this was rationale to explain, 2014, as I said again, was a year where our business really peaked. And in that year, there was a lot of new inflow of people. And this rationale was to explain or try to explain what was going on, what was bringing these people in, and would this continue or not. So, you know, there, I was careful. I always wanted to make sure that the lens that I looked through was farsighted, not just nearsighted, to look at, you know, what was more far reaching in addition to looking at what was the low hanging fruit. And because of this, I guess, and my time in development, I grew this habit of looking at what the geopolitical factors were happening overseas. It could be Asia, right from when Hong Kong, the late 80s to the early 90s, Taiwan right after that, PRC China right after that, PRC China being the largest amount. And I always wanted to get and understand the vibe and a tick of what was going on. And that was also the reason that I would spend time on the gaming floor, to be in the trenches, to get the feel of what was going on. I didn't want us in a very successful year like that to just drink our own Kool-Aid, thump our chest and say, we knocked it out of the park, we know what we're doing. I felt that, again, in our business, starting from the 80s all the way to current, what we got in business very much was fortuitous. It was serendipitous. We didn't go looking for it. It found us. We just happened to be in the right business in the right geographical part of the world that seemed to align perfectly with geopolitical situations such as Hong Kong wealthy people wanting to come to Vancouver for a safer haven in the event that things didn't work out when the handover back to China happened, followed by Taiwanese people that essentially there was a change in the government for the first time in 50 years, a new government other than the KMT party was going to rule Taiwan. And there was worries about political stability and what the new government may cause in terms of, you know, their family and the businesses that they ran over there. And mainland China, predominantly because the market opened up. It was a socialist government that embraced capitalism starting from the 90s. Also, I discovered that, you know, the Canadian government really wanted this money and attracted this money all the way from the 80s to current. The immigration laws were extremely lenient. They wanted the Hong Kong people wealthy. They got them. Same with the Taiwanese, but with the mainland Chinese. And specific to this period that you're talking about, I recall finding out that from that period, I was already thinking what geopolitical factors were in play here. From 2005 to 2012, the federal government created immigrant investor programs to attract wealthy Chinese, PRC Chinese to Canada. In those 7 years, 2005 to 2012, it was only terminated in 2013 because the backlog of applications reached a point where it would take them years to process. It was that successful. It amounted to, I believe the number was over 30,000 of China's richest, the top 1% of the wealthy, to immigrate to Canada. And also in that period, the federal government, once they implement this immigrant investor program, they allow each province individually to determine the criteria and qualifications. And so that initiative was called the PNP, or the Provincial Nomination Program. Essentially, they would vet the people applying for British Columbia, submit that to the federal government to approve. The majority of the wealthiest during that time coming to Canada ended up in Vancouver. So again, for us, I felt it was a direct correlation what's going on in there. I needed to stay in tune with everything that was going on. For this point number one, what had happened was the Chinese leadership changed beginning in the end of 2012. The president assumed general secretary, head of the Communist Party. He became president in early 2013, I believe in March. Call it what it is, it's all over the news. I'm not gonna judge it. I'm not a political science expert. It was officially China's anti-corruption flight capital. Some people refer to it as the political purge to rid himself of his enemies. I'm not gonna get into that because I'm not qualified to. That, in addition to what I stated earlier with the immigrant investor program under the PNP for British Columbia, brought all these people over. So we didn't do anything. It was a twist of fortune for us that it just lined up, just like River Rock, as a matter of fact, opened up in June of 2004, the month before in May, the first large-scale American casino opened up in Macau. And there's no doubt in my mind that benefited us directly, because the Venetian Sands opened up in Macau in May of 2004. It had a $265 million investment, as I recall. It had no hotel. It was just a casino. They rushed to open it. They built it just like we did River Rock in about a year or so. They got, and their gaming tax is 39, caught 40%. They got their full investment back in 9 months. They were not prepared for that. So what that did geopolitically is that the Chinese government, the Chinese citizens that never knew gaming before, became rich through the markets opening up, ended up exposed to Macau, that led them to learn how to play, that, by the way, they just happened to immigrate to Canada in that time period, and they already became experienced game players. And there was a lot of magic like that that happened that benefited us. For instance, the Chinese people were not easily able to travel to Macau because of China requiring, Macau is a special administrative region. You needed an exit visa from China in order to go to Macau. A lot of people aren't aware of this, but there's two visas that the Chinese need, an exit visa and then Canada or Macau to issue them an entry visa. But in another twist of fate, what happened was SARS happened in 2002. The people of Macau, the people of Hong Kong particularly, blame the Chinese government for covering that up, and that SARS was hitting southern China and affecting them. The Chinese government, as part of the damage control, allowed the borders to be open from China to Macau, China to Hong Kong, to repair any sort of damages done by that period. And when that border opened, the Chinese people gushed into Macau. And again, the Chinese people immigrated to Vancouver, now ready, stocked, and prepared to play. And for years overlapping from 2005 to 2012, these people just kept flowing in. It may sound crude, but they just washed up on shore.
That was Walter Hsu testifying at the Cullen Commission on February 9th. The Cullen Commission continues. Go to cullencommission.ca for the online hearing schedule. We're all in this together, and we've got to brave the stormy weather. You can count on us, we're your neighbor, and we're all in this.
together. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people across British Columbia that keep museums and archives open in every community, big and small. It is Heritage Week in BC, and you need to know the past to understand the present. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 14th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on February 14th in 2005, YouTube was launched? YouTube is another way you can listen to the Breaker.News podcast, by the way. The first video was shot at a zoo in San Diego, and it was uploaded in late April 2005, and it's been seen more than 152 million times. Now you know. Send me your feedback and send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.